Force majeure, an event that's above and beyond our control. That expression, borrowed by insurers from the French, to describe what may otherwise be seen as an act of God. Los Angeles's devastating wildfires certainly qualifying as force majeure, the explosive cocktail of prolonged drought, low humidity, and hurricane-force winds, together sparking an unprecedented disaster. However, is it all down to Mother Nature? What does it take to prevent and put out wildfires in times of global warming? There's what insurers should cover in earthquake, mudslide, and fire-prone Southern California, and what authorities should do, from building codes and safety norms to how much tax should be raised to fund rescue services. The well-to-do in the posh Pacific Palisades neighborhood will almost certainly land on their feet. Some even can pay for private firefighters. But what about the rest of the population? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking if we're ready for the new normal. And joining us from Los Angeles, she's been under an evacuation order, Franco-American novelist and television writer Vanina Marceau. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
From Seattle, Washington, on the West Coast, Crystal Raymond, Deputy Director of the Western Fire and Forest Resilience Collaborative Research Program. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for the invitation. Good to be here.
From London, Franziska Arnold-Dwyer, Associate Professor at University College London, UCL, the author of Insurance, Climate Change, and the Law. Thank you for joining us.
Good evening, and thank you for having me on the program.
And if you want to build a house in these times of global warming, you need an architect. Martin Duplantier of Martin Duplantier Architects is also curating the French Pavilion at the May Venice Biennale. That's taking place. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
You can listen. That's right. Listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Before we go to our panel, let's go to Los Angeles and the focus on those who've lost it all. France 24 correspondent Wassim Kalney reports.
Everywhere you look, there are thousands upon thousands of items of clothing. There are shoes, there's bedding, there are hygiene products, food, and water. This is all just a fraction of what has been donated here over the past few days. The people we spoke to saying all this help has been a lifeline.
We've just been holed up in a motel for the last couple days and trying to figure out where we're going to go from here.
Made a list, yeah. I mean, there's
Underwear, t-shirts,
those kinds of things. Toothbrush, toothpaste, basics.
Yeah, it was really that kind of stuff. We packed a suitcase before we left. I gave him a suitcase and said, put some clothes in for both of us to wear. So,
well, I found some pants, which is good because I only took sweats. So I've been schlepping around like a slob. So I'm happy to at least have a pair of jeans here. I think, you know, we're resilient, we're strong, we're Dina strong. I've always said that. You know, we've always taken care of our own. So, you know, that's what we're doing. It doesn't surprise me.
Everything's gone.
I'm so sorry.
So, yeah, we're just trying to rebuild, trying to keep the morale. I think this program really gives people the energy and the confidence to go on because it's hard. It's very hard losing a lot.
All day long and for the past few days, we've seen all these cars coming in with so many donations, volunteers also coming in strong. We have about 600 people helping out here today.
We can cross live now to Wassim Kalney. Wassim, you went on Monday and visited with those at a clothes drop. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so this was the Santa Anita racetrack that has been the location where most of the East LA locations in terms of help have been donating all of that help. And that is for primarily for the people affected from Pasadena, Altadena, the people of the victims of the Eaton fire. And, you know, showing up Monday, and this was already 2 or 3 days into the donation effort, there were still thousands upon thousands of items of clothing. There were shoes, there was bedding, there was food, hygiene products, water, basically anything you could possibly need to sort of at least sustain you for the first few days following this terrible disaster. And this was a work week. We ended up going on a Monday, and we were told that there were 600 volunteers who showed up throughout the day to help these people, to help, you know, put everything in boxes, to help distribute all of these items. And we left around, what, 5 p.m., I believe, and there were still dozens of cars waiting, lined up to bring donations. And so this was obviously a very widespread community effort. The people we spoke to, some of them who had lost everything, told us essentially that this community coming together was the only thing keeping them going right now.
And keeping them going. I see that it's sunny blue skies behind you 1 week on. But what we can't see is whether or not the winds have picked up as predicted by forecasters.
Yeah, so there is a major difference with the dramatic wind event that led to all these fires last week is that the areas under wind alerts and red flag warnings are very much less widespread than they were last week. So places like the L.A. Basin here, which is essentially all of central Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles as we know it, they are not under red flag warnings because those winds are not as expected to be as strong. So it's going to be breezy a little bit here in Hollywood, but nothing compared to last week when I was woken up Tuesday morning by these vicious, vicious winds. However, those winds, those red flag warnings, those high fire conditions will affect much of the valleys north and east, northeast of Los Angeles, San Fernando Valley, the San Gabriel Valley, west of the city, like the Santa Monica Mountains. Those are places like Malibu, like the western tip of the Pacific Palisades, some of the areas affected by the Eden fire as well. So again, this is not, we're certainly not out of the woods. The people in Los Angeles proper are probably not going to be seeing any extreme fire conditions, but people in other suburbs certainly will. And so that is why authorities are asking people to be very careful. There have been masks that have been distributed in anticipation of these fires potentially decreasing the air quality over the next few days. But the good news is that firefighters have been able to make significant progress over the past 2 to 3 days. Cal Fire last night saying that there had been no significant reactivation or reignition of either of these fires for at least 36 hours. But what firefighters have been doing for the past 2 to 3 days, essentially combing through all these ashes, through all this debris, using their hands, using infrared cameras to essentially make sure that there are no hot spots, to make sure that none of these fires will reactivate with these stronger winds in the forecast.
And there are strict orders not to return to some neighborhoods. There's been, I know, at least 9 suspected looters who've been arrested. More broadly, Wasim, there's the investigation into what happened.
Yeah, so obviously an investigation on multiple fronts. Let's start with the Palisades fire. And I mean, I was mentioning the reactivation, the danger of reignition of these fires. The investigation has been handed to ATF, which is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives. And all day yesterday, all of Monday, there were agents on a specific hill essentially the top of Pacific Palisades, looking at the potential start to a fire. Because based on videos that have been posted online, based on witnesses who were there when that fire started Tuesday, it appears that that location is where the fire started. And what is important here is that there was a fire there on New Year's Eve that was started by fireworks. Now, that fire on December 31st, the early hours of January 1st, was rapidly contained and put out by firefighters. But authorities are looking at the possibility that that fire might not have been completely put out, and that it continued burning, that there were embers underneath all these ashes that were reactivated a week later by these vicious, vicious winds that we saw, wind gusts of over 130, 140 kilometers per hour last Tuesday. Another important point in the investigation, one resident at Pacific Palisades has now filed a lawsuit against the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power because that Pacific Palisades reservoir closest to that area was empty when that fire broke out. And so one point worth pointing out is that in a statement issued last week, the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, also mentioned that in the investigation that he was launching. Now, authorities, some fire officials have said that having that fire, that reservoir full would not have made much of a difference. But again, that lawsuit has been filed now to try to figure out exactly whether it would have made a difference and whether it could have helped some firefighters in that battle. And finally, talking about the Eden fire, which burned parts of Altadena, northeast of Los Angeles. Well, another resident who lost his home in that fire is now suing Southern California Edison, SoCal Edison, that is the utilities company here, for not following its own plan to turn off power in the event of those strong winds. Because again, there is a video that is so that was circulating online that was handed over to authorities showing sparks flying in front of or just near a utilities transmission tower just minutes before that fire broke out. Obviously, this was 8 hours after the Pacific Palisades fire began, and so this resident believes that it was gross negligence that led the utilities company to not turn off power, especially given the dramatic weather conditions that day.
Wassim Cornet, many thanks for that live update from Los Angeles. Vanina Marceau, listening, is that where the mindset is right now into figuring out what just happened? When you hear your reaction, when you hear about those lawsuits against the water company, against the power company?
You know, there's been so much talk on social media about who to blame. I think given the scope of the damage, people are looking for someone to blame. And I've heard everything from the fire chief to the mayor to the governor to Southern California Edison to the utilities company to, I mean, I think it's more important to look at the fact that we haven't taken climate change seriously for the past 50 years. If there's anyone to point anything to point the finger at, it's climate change. I mean, this is devastating here in California, but these fires have become more and more frequent as natural climate disasters have become more frequent all over the country. I was reading about the Smokehouse Creek fire in Texas last year that burned over 1 million acres. And we haven't, there's Hurricane Helene in Florida. All of these disasters are increasing because we're not taking climate change seriously. So if that's where I think we should be pointing fingers.
Crystal Raymond, you're listening in from Seattle. And, you know, we're used to making jokes about how much it rains. But a few years back, they had a so-called heat dome episode where you are. When you think back to that and you watch what's happening now, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, we know that many people live in the West in areas that are very prone to wildfire. That's true here in Washington State. That's true throughout California. And we have clear scientific evidence that climate change is contributing to wildfire, increasing the length of our fire season, increasing the area burned, and frequency of these large fires. So the scientific evidence is clear, and what we really need to see is this recognition that we live in fire-prone areas and start to take greater measures.
And your reaction, Crystal, to that lawsuit over a reservoir that's empty?
Yeah, I don't know about a lawsuit specifically related to the reservoir, but we do know that we need to create situations where more resilient to these situations. We shouldn't be surprised when these conditions happen because they're happening more frequently. And so we need to take steps, both the government, both individuals, so that we're prepared for these situations and we're able to handle them as they come because we know that the frequency is going to increase.
Well, Francisca Arnold-Dwyer, what struck you the most in the past week in all of this?
Well, as we've heard numbers coming through of losses totaling over $2 billion, the costliest of losses in U.S. history, we've also heard that the projected insured losses, as reported by J.P. Morgan, are estimated at $20 billion, or by Bloomberg only at $30 billion, so only a fraction of the overall losses. And this puts, once again, insurance company into the spotlight. And so the question arises, are they doing their job and paying claims?
So, Francisca, on this point, I remember in 1999, we had a major storm in the Paris area, and it was huge damage. And it was just before the new year. And a friend of mine who's a scientist said, the weather's political. When insurers have to cough up enough times, that'll be the end of the discussion on climate change. And yet we're still having it.
That's true. And it's put the insurance industry and the home insurance market in a crisis because the climate change drives weather changes and also changes in the frequency and severity of natural disasters. And this means that insurers have to pay out more often. Then they have to charge higher premium because their business model is based upon premium charges that cover the claims of a few for a large pool of insureds. So to make this work, the money they charge must exceed the claims and on top of a slice of regulatory capital. And as natural catastrophes become more frequent and also more severe, this model is out of kilter. So we are in a situation where there's an elevated risk of wildfire in California, in the LA region. So premiums become unaffordable, especially for lower income households. And then households decide not to buy insurance. And then when disaster strikes, they're not insured and cannot claim.
I want to revisit that point, just before we talk about the cost of all of this, Martin Duplantier, first of all, your reaction to the fact that there's a lawsuit over a reservoir gone dry.
Well, of course, it's probably easy to point out such misunderstanding or lack of water at a certain point. But I think the problem is much, much bigger than this. And I'm not sure if this reservoir would have saved the neighborhood and the 12,000 houses that went into flames.
Is it just, since Los Angeles is home to Hollywood, we all remember the 1974 Roman Polanski movie, Chinatown, and it's all about who gets to control the water supply into Los Angeles, and that movie set in the 1940s. Isn't it just about you shouldn't build cities in places where there's not enough water?
Well, if you look at the Californian context, you understand that Northern California is providing most of the water to Southern California. So, first of all, it's a much wider understanding of the territory and of geography than just the area of Los Angeles. So, of course, because we're, moving massive amounts of water to Phoenix, to cities like Los Angeles, etc., that probably wouldn't be naturally able to sustain, a full year-long water supply, that this population has been enjoying sun, that has been enjoying warm temperatures. But let's come back to reality. In the history of urbanism, cities have always had to adapt to their surroundings. And the hard thing here is that radical changes are coming. And because it's so radical and so rapid, so quick, we don't have the time to adapt our cities. But the failure or the error that we should avoid is to build back as it was.
And
that's the big challenge.
Is that what people are clamoring for where you are, Vanina? Build it right back the same way it was? You are in the land of the free, as it calls itself.
I haven't heard much clamor to rebuild yet. I've heard a lot of talk about how we will rebuild. Certainly, when you look at the overhead shots of the devastation of the Palisades, it's an entire community that is gone. And I think the same is true of the Altadena neighborhood in the Eaton fire. So I think we will rebuild. I think right now people are still trying to figure out, how they're going to land, given just the incredible paperwork that will be involved in trying to get insurance settlements if people do have insurance. I know a lot of insurance companies have refused to insure people who live in wildfire areas. And, at this point, practically all of Los Angeles is a wildfire area, especially all of the communities that are in the mountains. And we have two sets of mountains in this area, the Santa Monica Mountains that bisect the city, and the San Gabriel Mountains. So I think it's a little premature to be talking about clamoring for rebuilding, but I think there's a feeling of optimism that people are trying to cling to given just the scope of the devastation, because otherwise we'd just all, completely collapse.
It's interesting to see some of the reactions that we've seen. It's this lack of preparedness. Less than 24 hours into the L.A. fires, there was what Vanina described, that blame game already taking place at the national level in the U.S., the Republican president-elect of the United States blaming the catastrophe on the Democratic governor of California, The fire's feeding a political echo chamber ever since. Let me show you today's cover of the Rupert Murdoch-owned New York Post, which blares that California Governor Gavin Newsom, quote, spent big on green energy deals, but cut fire prevention. I guess it's a short stretch to blaming green energy deals for fires, but obviously that's not what's being said there, Crystal Raymond. What is interesting to note, though, is it's this question of what's the role of government in all of this.
Yeah, I think it's really unfortunate to see wildfire be made political in this way. I mean, whatever side of the spectrum you're on, you can be affected by these wildfires. And I think, you know, we know we're not putting enough of resources towards the solutions that we have available. We know a lot of what the solutions are. When we talk about building back, people can build back better, and we know what those solutions are. But, you know, we need incentives and we need government support to help these communities be better designed when they do come back.
Build back better is how?
We know the sorts of building materials that can go into buildings to make them more resistant to wildfire. We know how to design communities.
For instance, what kind of building materials?
Yeah, I mean, we know that building, you know, with cedar shake, with building with wood on the outsides as opposed to materials that are designed to withstand fire doesn't work. We know about the screens so that you can block openings so that embers don't come into houses to catch them on fire. These sorts of resources are available. And insurance plays a role in that. There's not a strong enough structure within insurance to incentivize people to make those changes and to actually be rewarded for that in terms of reduced rates on their insurance, because that structure isn't fully in place to do that. But we do have solutions. And I think that we need to sort of resist that urge that we've just got to, you know, get back, we've got to build back, but actually to take this as an opportunity to say, we do know what some of those things are that we can put in place to design these neighborhoods. It won't protect every structure, but it increases the chances that we can protect more homes when these events do happen.
The last time you were with us, Martin Duplantier, was to talk about the inauguration of the Olympic Village here in Paris. And it had a neat design with the fact that you had a building structure that had coolants and heatings using the waters from the showers. It made it much more energy efficient. You said you didn't even need air conditioners for these buildings. But there is you said there was an upfront cost. So you pay more when you build. And in what was just been described there by Crystal, is it pay more up front to save more later?
Yes, but on the other hand, I think it's we're talking here about micro solutions, about solutions at the scale of a building, which can be, you know, dealing with the entire building, which can be dealing with just a part of it, can be a shelter. And then the rest of the building can be, you know, more, let's say, open to the surroundings, because we don't want to live in bunkers, I think. You know, if we choose to live around L.A., that's because of the beautiful trees, because of the beautiful landscape, so we don't want to be stuck in a concrete bunker. But I think the other, I think, and more decisive impact that we can have is on the urban level. That's why I'm talking about neighborhoods, about communities that have to gather and have to decide, you know, what is the density? What is the
fewer houses is what you're saying.
Exactly. What is the offset with the forest? What should the forest look like? How is it maintained? I mean, all of that is linked. If we talk and if we look only at the building, then we're going to see that happening again. So that's a three-dimensional and also a short mid and long-term vision that we have together with the communities to raise up and to build.
Again, Crystal Raymond, I go back to the question I posed to you earlier, is how much of what that planning when it comes to managing forests and all that is down to ethics that have to come from public authorities in the name of public safety?
Yeah, I think there's certainly an aspect of it that needs to come from the public. I also think it can come from individuals and it can come from neighborhoods and communities. If one individual does a lot to protect their house and build in a certain way that they're resistant to fire, it may not be useful if their neighbor doesn't do it as well. And so, yes, there's certainly a role for government, and there's a role for communities and individuals and the private sector too, in terms of how insurance can step in and incentivize this sorts of behavior and reaction as well. So I think there's roles for all sides on this issue.
All right, we have in the United States a new administration that's coming in. Under the first incarnation of Donald Trump, federal taxes were cut, and that put a strain on state and local budgets. What is true is that the mayor of Los Angeles has taken heat in the last week for slashing the fire department's budget while increasing that of the police.
The fire chief and I are focused on fighting these fires and saving lives. And any differences that we might have will be worked out in private. But right now, our first and most important obligation to Angelenos is to get through this crisis.
Vanina Marceau, people where you are, are demanding more funding for the fire department. Are they ready for more taxes?
I honestly don't know where to fall on this issue, because there has been so much reported about it recently that the fire department has been cut, and yet Cal Fire's budget is $3.8 billion. That's almost doubled since 2019. Newsweek reported that this $100 million cut to the fire budget, but apparently that was the proposed budget. The actual cuts did reduce the wildfire package, but California wildfires, their budget is twice as big as it was in 2019. So I don't know who we're supposed to blame in this. And again, I think it's part of the blame game that people want to play during a crisis. It's clear that to rebuild California is going to cost a lot of money. At the same time, California is, what, the fifth largest economy in the world? So I think there's ample sources for that money, and I think a lot of it should come from government, considering it's not as if you can pick up the city and move it somewhere else. This is where it is.
All right, among the vocal critics of the mayor is her electoral rival from last time around, billionaire real estate mogul Rick Caruso, who was very vocal in the first days of the L.A. wildfires last week, but has had to do some damage control of his own amid reports that he hired private firefighters to protect his Brentwood home and Palisades Village. That's a retail residential complex that he also owns. The L.A. Times interviewed an off-duty firefighter from Los Alamitos, that's south of Los Angeles, who'd been hired by a private contracting firm called West Coast Water Tenders. Private firefighters, Vanina?
You know, I heard about this too. There was some guy, I can't remember his name, on Twitter putting out a post for asking for, who knows, a private firefighter company to save my house. Kind of money, not an object kind of thing. I don't know. This strikes me as an extremely dangerous road to go down if we're just going to have private wealthy people being able to protect their homes and everyone else, well, fend for yourselves or whatever resources are available. I mean, I kind of find it despicable.
Crystal Raymond, is this something new or has this always existed?
I think this has been around for a while. I mean, I think the private sector is always going to step in when there's a void, when there's insufficient, you know, role of the government in protecting people. I agree that it's unfortunate. But I also think, you know, that's kind of inevitable. When there's a void, we're going to see the private sector step in.
Sitting in Paris, Martin Duplantier, your thoughts on private contractors for policing and fire?
Well, for us French, it sounds, you know, out of our minds, out of culture. But I do understand when you have so much assets, real estate, that you want to protect it. That's quite natural. The thing is that we should probably think about common solutions rather than private ones. And there is, in my view, a much more bigger role to play on the public level at the scale of the municipality and the Los Angeles County to see what is the Los Angeles of 2025 and 2030 and 40. We're looking at the Olympics with also a bit of fear and doubts. And I think it's very important that they give a new light of what is the future of the city and how this city can transform and adapt itself to this new norm.
Vanina, the Olympics are, what, 3.5 years away where you are in Los Angeles. Is there really a threat that preparations may be disrupted?
I mean, I don't know much about it, but to be honest, given all the construction that Paris did for the Paris Olympics, you've got to imagine that there are plans to build structures and facilities to host the Olympics, which they're going to have to be doing at the same time that they're rebuilding the city from these fires. It seems like an awful lot of money is going to need to be funneled to Los Angeles to complete both of those tasks.
Yeah, for many who've now lost their homes or businesses comes the challenge, and we touched on it a little bit earlier, of convincing insurers to pay. Delana D'Souza has more on that.
In this Los Angeles neighborhood ravaged by wildfires, a resident returns to inspect the damage. Jesus Hernandez finds his home has been completely destroyed.
Again, you would be met with the living room, which is literally right here in this area.
As Jesus inspects what little remains, worry starts to mount.
Hopefully the insurance can pay for, you know, most of it. If not, then we're going to have to stay with friends or someone.
Many residents in Southern California remain anxious as insurance companies have suspended or limited their coverage in the past 2 years. In the affluent neighborhood of Pacific Palisades, thousands of contracts have been canceled. This couple struggled but eventually found an insurance policy days before last week's fire broke out.
I wonder how many other people weren't able to get that policy at the 11th hour because you worked very hard to get it.
Between recurring wildfires, flooding, and the risk of an earthquake, California remains costly for insurance firms eager to leave the state. Authorities have now forbidden companies from canceling policies for the next year.
So right now, my immediate goal is to make sure that we get the claims paid as quick as possible and that we get people on the road to recovery as quickly as we can.
While experts estimate the damage and economic loss could cost between $135 to $150 billion, insurance companies could wind up paying nearly $20 billion.
So, Francisca Arnold-Dwyer, several questions. First one, at what point does a geographical area become uninsurable? Is Los Angeles nearly uninsurable at this point?
There are several factors playing into it. So uninsurability is if losses are so catastrophic that they can't be pooled, they're not capable of being insured. However, the one of the issues in California is also a different one, which is that the California insurance regulator regulates the level of insurance premium, which means that insurers cannot charge a premium that's risk reflective. And this makes it uneconomic for insurers to provide homeowner insurance to some of these households. Because of this problem, California has also come up with a partial solution, which is called Fair Plan, which is sort of a statutory syndicated fire insurance pool. So rich homeowner who are unable to buy insurance can still buy insurance. However, the problem with Fair Plan is that it's not cheap either, and also that claims are limited to a three million maximum ceiling. So there is a question of uninsurability in the sense that insurers have no appetite to offer insurance in California, but also that it's unaffordable for some households.
And on that point, Francisca, how do you explain more nationally this sort of backlash against insurance companies. It was illustrated by that murder of an insurance company executive in New York by a young man who had traveled, who had lived for a while in California. Your thoughts on that? Why is this sort of rage against insurers right now?
Yeah, so there's a perception that insurance companies are just charging these high premiums but are not paying claims. And it's sort of been said that this guy, Luigi Mangione, was allegedly motivated by a resentment on what he said is of parasitic health insurance. So it's this feeling of powerlessness that that you think you buy a service, a financial product, but then it lets you down, or it doesn't give you as much financial protection as you have been expected. So, but again, there's of it's. When you look at what insurance companies offer, it's sort of governed by their sort of terms and conditions, and there are limits in the policies. Policies have exclusions. They don't cover. Sometimes they don't cover specific assets for which you need a specialist policy. So it's a complicated picture. And
a really complicated picture, but Francisca, that perception that insurance companies are ripping people off—is it grounded in fact?
In insurance companies, they are companies that are accountable to their shareholders and investors, so they do have to make a profit. They do have to hold regulatory capital, and they have to make enough money to pay claims to be financially stable, or they will lose their license. If the regulator sets premium controls that doesn't allow insurance companies to charge the premium they need to pay claims, then you've got to have at least a slice of sympathy for insurance companies that decide not to do any further business in California.
Vanina Marceau, it's for many of those, and I'm sure you know some who have lost their homes or had their goods damaged. It's going to be a long haul to getting their claims.
It is. There's an immense amount of paperwork. As someone who had to deal with flood damage about a decade ago, the paperwork is enormous. We live, my mother's house is in an area that is, we evacuated from because it was in a precautionary evacuation area and my mother is elderly. But it's an area that is very, very vulnerable to wildfires because it's up in the Santa Monica Mountains. We have to have the California Fair Plan as part of our insurance. And I know people who in neighboring areas who have been denied insurance because of where they live, which is just adding to the tragedy of this event.
Yeah, here in France, 2024 was marred by huge flooding in the north of the country. There were ocean storms. In the south, you had intense heat and long spells of drought in many places. Insurance premiums climbing an average of 7.2% last year. Martin Duplantier, we're looking at that map there showing where those premiums rose the most. And again, the architect in you, what does he say when he looks at that map of France?
I just think that you cannot buy a house if you don't have an insurance. You don't get your mortgage, and the bank doesn't allow you to sign the contract. So you need of course insurances, and they will inevitably increase their
premiums. But do you blame the insurers, or do you blame global warming for what that we've seen there?
We all know for the last, 50 years that we're on the road to global warming. So, of course, this will cost more. We'll have to adapt our cities. But, you know, every euro, every dollar that we spend on adapting is actually a good investment rather than seeing what we see here on the screens, which is to recover from a disaster. So every investment on preventing, on increasing our resilience is a good investment.
Yeah, there was an Atlantic Coast storm more than a decade ago at Cynthia, where they were orders to tear down the buildings, and it took years for people to move.
Exactly. We see that on, you know, I come from the southwest of France, on the southwest of the Atlantic coast. We also see some cities that are thinking about moving the entire cities, because we know that the coastline is going to, you know, change a lot, and we won't be able to pay for every single house in this particular situation. So there are some very contextual situations where we have to imagine, and we have the solutions. We know what to do, but let's invest now rather than wait too long.
So there's zoning, like you say, and what Crystal Raymond was talking about earlier, the materials you use. How do you design your house of the future? What do you use in particular?
It all depends on the context, again. I've been working in the Philippines after some typhoon events in 2014, and we had to work on the house of the future in the Philippines. And we had to take inspirations from parts of the tropical world where they've been suffering from typhoons every single year. And when you look at these kind of typologies, then you know what to do. So I think that, you know, we've been building houses for centuries, and we've had in certain regions fires every year. We've had typhoons every year in certain regions. The solutions are there. Plus, now we have we have artificial intelligence. We have data. We have satellites. So I think by gathering the different kinds of intelligences, we can really come up with smart solutions.
Vanina Marceau, you are in what's called Tinseltown. The show must go on. Are people getting on with their lives?
You know, it's very strange because for the first time last night, I saw traffic on the 405 and the 10 freeways, whereas the previous 5 days it felt like a ghost town. So I got to think that people are trying to go about their ordinary lives to the extent that they can. But it's a weird feeling. It's a very strange feeling, despite the beautiful sunny sky and blue skies. LA feels changed.
We'll have to leave it there for now. Vanina Marceau, we wish you and yours the best in these trying times. I want to thank Crystal Raymond for being with us from Seattle, Francisca Arnold-Dwyer in London, Martin Duplantier, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.